Hello and welcome to episode 226 of the Fabulous Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Poliachi Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carasino.
And we are coming to you as usual in different locations. I am in Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Pelton Cast.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion Seattle Seahawks.
Hello.
Hello.
We are 3 days as we record this, even fewer as you listen to this, away from the first annual, the fourth annual Pelton Cast live show, but the first annual, hopefully not annual, Pelton Cast live from home on Zoom coming up this Friday. The excitement is palpable.
Wow. Well, I think before we get into that any further, we've got to crack this week's beer because we have got a lot of toast to get to.
We do. The seasons are changing. Labor Day is past. You may not know it from how hot it is outside right now here in Seattle, but fall is upon us. We're going to preview a football game that's going to count, played by your Seattle Seahawks, at the end of this podcast. But it's also a more important season than football season. And you know what season that is? You probably do. It's not really a legitimate question to you, but the listener may not know. It's fresh hop season.
This is the fresh hop season of our discontent.
I guess it probably is, isn't it? The first fresh hop out there on the market that I've seen, friend of the podcast Ross Seiler tweeted about this, so shouts to him. And I made plans to go pick it up in time for the pod. The Two Beers Fresh Hop IPA, this hyper-seasonal IPA.
Two Beers? Sorry.
Is a Two Beers brewing tradition not to be missed. A brewer's road trip provides us with some of the first hops of the Yakima Valley hop harvest. The result is an intoxicatingly aromatic IPA that is new and exciting every year.
Wow. And it tastes good. Fresh hop season is upon us, boys. Let's go get them.
I mean, I have a goal this year to drink more fresh hop beers than I drank last year. I don't think I tried enough different ones.
We're only drinking fresh hops. The hops, they're so fresh.
They could not be any fresher.
You know what else we are drinking this week. Maybe not you, but I am. Hello.
There it is.
It's a Rainier Tall Boy because, as you mentioned, the fourth annual Pelton Cast Live this year from home edition will be this Friday, September 11th at 9 o'clock p.m., you know what to expect from the Pelton Cast Live. That is special guests like Natalie Weiner, Michael Sean Duggar, doing a Seahawks season preview, talking taco time with, wait for it.
Yeah, we're announcing some additional third Pelton brothers this week that we had not previously confirmed. So talking taco time, I'm very excited about this. We'll be with Trailblazers courtside reporter Brooke Olsendam, a huge taco time supporter. Have gone through her taco time tweets. She has asked to be sponsored by them. We'll see if we can make that happen with this interview.
You have seen her on the sidelines. Now you can see her in the drive-thru on Talkin' Taco Time. We will, of course, be joined by the Talkin' Taco Time co-host Chris Smith and Randy with 8 A's. Everybody is ready for that one. Plus, we, of course, have DJ Infrared heckling in the chat. We have the decider, Zach Whitman, helping us crown Seattle's best teriyaki, or maybe Mill Creek's. And you know we had to do it to him.
I mean, when we were able to do this live show from home, or forced to do this live show from home, it opened up our world of third Pelton brother possibilities outside the city of Seattle. So we are so excited to welcome is our special guest this year, a longtime third Pelton brother, a frequent contributor, a favorite of this show, ESPN NFL analyst Mina Kimes.
We started Pelton Cast Live with the traitor and Danny Kelly, and we will end Pelton Cast Live with another traitor in Mina Kimes. That's
so excited
right.
About that.
LA Rams season preview. Who will start at running back this year for the Rams? Is it Cam Akers? Is it Daryl Henderson? Answers to all of the questions you've been asking. This is a Van Jefferson hype podcast.
Oh, no. Where did we go wrong? Was it when I took Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp with back-to-back picks in our fantasy draft earlier this evening? It may have been that. Or was it when you took both Cam Akers and Daryl Henderson Jr.?
More on that later. Mina Kimes will be joining us for Seahawks hype over Zoom. We cannot wait. There are many people staying up way past their bedtimes. So the least you could do is join us this Friday, September 11th. The link will be tweeted out. It will be posted. Link in bio, as they say on Instagram. It will be available for you. And, of course, as always, BYO Rainier.
And so our plan is to open it up a little early, get there early just in case. Make sure you're ready. We're going to go fairly promptly at 9 o'clock, I think, because it is pretty late for those people on the East Coast. Natalie's tweeted today that she finally realized that this was starting at midnight, and unfortunately she's not on the first segment. So, you know.
The takes get hotter. One important note that we have to mention here. Wait, where did you have more?
No, that was it, except I was going to make some more Pelton Cast Time Zone jokes.
Oh, wait. That's one important note that we have to mention. This is a correction. Initial comments may have listed Pelton Cast Live as 9 o'clock p.m. PST, and we have to issue a formal correction. It is not going to be 9 o'clock p.m. PST. Do not mark your calendars for that time. It is going to be at 9 o'clock p.m. PDT. That is in Pacific Daylight Time. Please do not be confused. Go back, update your calendars. I know that you'd converted it from PST to PDT that we are currently in. So go ahead and update those.
Are you actually an expert in this, as you implied on Twitter?
Absolutely am. Here's the thing.
You said if you reviewed it, which you did review it. You saw it. It was posted in the group chat that we're all in.
Look, there was no specific written approval.
Shout to the famous cousin Katie, by the way, is behind that amazing graphic.
That's the other thing, is that you are also getting it Pelton Cast Live. You didn't hear us, one of the special guests, but you get the famous cousin Katie, too.
The people who demanded
not
it.
Not turning her Zoom on. You get all the exciting famous cousin Katie experiences. Being called out in the chat and not responding to it. It's everything you could expect from the famous cousin Katie, plus Mrs. Famous Fantasy Genius in the chat as well. So, on the PST to PDT time zone conversation.
Geez. We got a lot of sports to get to this week. Let's not bog down here.
While I was working at a booking agency, you do a lot of emailing with regards to specific times. And my coworker, Josh Lindgren, is an expert in the PST or PDT description of a time zone. Literally, I did not know that was a thing. And Katie didn't either. Like, I'm just like, it's PST. It's always PST. That's just Pacific Standard Time. That's what it is. And he was like, no, that's wrong. It's either standard or daylight time. I flipped personally to just saying Pacific.
That's the play I used to do.
Or PT, Pacific time, right? Yep. You don't even say it's not standard, it's not daylight. Nobody knows. But I love the idea that Pacific Standard Time, most people think that's just what the time zone is, because it's like standard time.
Yeah.
It's like, it's fucking time, dude. Like, not, it's like standard time. Don't use anything weird, just like the standard time that we all use.
As opposed to military time.
Right?
Which is 2100 like, hours
just fucking PDT. Time, guy. Just don't go use any sort of crazy time. Just the standard time, okay? So I always really loved that idea that everybody who listed is permanently Pacific Standard Time, just like standard time, nothing weird, nothing crazy, just standard time, okay?
Time is a construct.
Anyway, we will see you 9 p.m. Friday, 9/11 PDT.
Now that it's Friday, you don't have to keep mentioning what day it is. Why do you keep doing that? It's a real divide between the Fabulous
Friday,
Funk Brothers.
September 11th, 9 o'clock p.m. PDT. The link will be tweeted out on the Peltoncast Twitter, Peltoncast Instagram, wherever you engage with your Peltoncast. Maybe even in the description of the podcast.
Eventually, yes. We don't currently have it, so not yet. As we record this on PDT, there's still an hour and 40 minutes left in Mina's birthday. So happy birthday to Third Belton brother Mina Kimes.
There we go. Cheers. A toast.
There was a great LA Times feature by former UW Daily reporter Tukni Nguyen on Mina's career path, so be sure to check that out. All right, our next toast. Congrats to Bremerton's own Marvin Williams on his retirement after 15 NBA seasons. The number 2 overall pick of the 2005 draft, played for just 4 teams, which kind of shocked me. I did not realize that he had played for that
I can think of at least 8 teams that he played for.
Before concluding his career with a short stint with the Bucks this season, among players born in the state of Washington, according to StatHead.com, Marvin Williams ranks 3rd in career win shares, 5th in games and points, and 2nd in rebounds, giving him a permanent spot on the guard-heavy All-Washington team. All right, lastly this week.
You're not going to make me guess the top 2 if he's 3rd in win shares?
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, you want to go for it.
Isaiah Thomas?
No.
Because he didn't play it long enough?
Yeah.
B-Roy?
No.
Also didn't play long enough?
Yeah, you know, a lot of Washington guards not known for their longevity, but there are a couple. First off, don't think Seattle-centric on this one.
John Stockton.
John Stockton is obviously number 1 by a million miles. I think he's number 1 in win shares, period. He's definitely, like, way up there.
Of any player ever?
I mean, he's probably not number 1 outside the advanced stats era, but he played a long-ass time.
Jet Terry.
Jason Terry is number 2.
Nailed it. Boom! Yeah. Wasn't he number 3?
Marvin is number 3, Jamal Crawford is number 4, and then James Edwards, number 5, Doug Christie, number 6, Isaiah Thomas, Brandon Roy, Steve Hawes, and Rodney Stuckey rounding out the top 10.
Rodney Stuckey, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
So there you go. There you go.
Big Marv.
Now give me a second to fill here while I look up career win shares total and see where John Stockton ranks, which is not as high as I thought. It's 6th. He's behind Michael Jordan. Kareem, Wilt, LeBron, Karl Malone, Michael Jordan, John Stockton.
Behind Michael Jordan.
Okay, lastly this week, on a more somber tone, you know, all right. Gotta restart that entirely.
Speaking of 9/11.
Oh, never. No. On a more somber note, we're pouring one out this week because we lost a legendary broadcaster, Bob Robertson, the longtime voice of the Washington State Cougars, who died Sunday at age 92. Robertson spent an incredible 52 seasons calling WSU football, an unthinkable amount, as well as a brief 3-season stint broadcasting UW football from 1969 to 71 because of some changes in which stations held the rights. We'll always remember Robertson's famous sign-off, always be a good sport, always. All right, with that, let's move forward as we move down to our final 2 in our search for Seattle's best teriyaki. We decided last week that Toshi's Teriyaki Grill, the originator in Mill Creek, was automatically advanced into the final, but we had 4 choices in this elaborate semifinal as to who would be matching up.
Every search for Seattle's best of is just like this current baseball season. We just make up all the rules going into it. Sometimes as it's happening.
And weirdly, the Mariners never win any of those searches either. So the 4 that advanced to this semifinal round: Choice Deli and Grocery in Ballard, Ichiro Teriyaki in Magnolia, Teriyaki Madness and Yoshino Teriyaki, both in Capitol Hill. And they are sort of like 2 competitions, because geographically we went to 2 of them at the same time, had them on the same plate. But then also they're different styles, because We got the spicy, very similar spicy at Choice Deli and Ichiro, the more spicy ones. There's the spicy at Yoshino, but it's not quite as aggressively spicy against Teriyaki Madness. And there, too, I would say old school teriyaki chains in or shops, I guess. Is that a fair assessment?
Sure.
All right, so let's start with Choice and Ichiro.
Yeah, those are the ones we had today. So I had these broken up by quite a long period of time. Definitely spicier. And I don't know if I got the spicy last time at Ichiro. I have to say, they've also both included onions, right?
Correct.
I thought they were both pretty good. Oh. It's such a tough search that I really, even differentiating between these two teriyakis was difficult.
I wanted to give Choice a second chance. As we talked about last week, I ate it on a bench in Myrtle Edwards Park with limited water, and the heat was too much for me at that point. It came out of nowhere. It was too much for me. This time I was prepared. I had all the water I needed. I was ready.
A gallon of milk next to you.
I enjoyed the experience dramatically more.
Dramatically more. Wow.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, it was kind of an actively bad experience in some ways the previous time.
Okay, this it was not. Do you have a preference between these two? Should we crown a champion of each of the regions and then have those two face off? Okay.
I think so. Ichiro is my choice here. I mean, it's long. This is like my home teriyaki for a long period of time. Although, interestingly, I never had the spicy when I went there when we worked at the Storm in Inner Bay, not far from there.
Used to have weak taste buds, but okay.
And I tried the spicy, and what I like about it relative to the Choice Deli spicy, and maybe even the Yoshino, even though it's not, again, as aggressively spicy, is the combination of still being sweet while being spicy, which is what I want, I think, in my spicy chicken teriyaki.
I am totally fine with that. You know, the thing to me is, as far as the winner goes, Choice Deli makes very good teriyaki. It is not a teriyaki restaurant.
That is true.
And if you're looking at the teriyaki to teriyaki, honestly, like I can find positives and negatives in each. I think that both are very good.
I thought the onions were better at Choice Deli. I thought that was a plus. And there was a larger quantity this time. That was maybe a difference having a takeout at Ichiro as opposed to when I've gone there in person in the past.
Neither one of these two. Really, you know, this was a Foles Trubisky type situation. You know, neither one of them claimed the title necessarily, but at the same time, you've got a Super Bowl winner and an NFC North champion, right? You've got two very good teriyakis here, and I'm giving the edge, as you say, to Ichiro, partially just because it's a teriyaki restaurant. Like, this is what they do. Choice Deli makes very good teriyaki, but they do so much more than that. They don't need this as much.
All right, let's talk about Teriyaki Madness in Yoshino. Again, two of the OGs, I would say, in Seattle teriyaki. Now, I would say coming into this, I was advocating for Teriyaki Madness, and you seemed much higher on Yoshino than I was.
Correct.
And one thing that changed is you previously had spicy when you went to Teriyaki Madness?
Yes.
And this time we got the regular.
Yes.
How did that change your perception of it?
Yeah, it was interesting. So I didn't know which was which when I had them, because you got both of them, and I honestly guessed incorrectly which of the teriyakis was which. The way that the sauce permeates through everything in the Yoshino teriyaki is very impressive.
Yes.
And I hadn't gotten the spicy there before.
It also permeated through my bag, as it turned out.
That's part of the teriyaki experience. Look, if your entire car isn't stained sticky with teriyaki sauce, you're doing it wrong. The sauce, the way that it gets into the rice, right? Like,
yep.
The way that it's part the rice and the teriyaki, it's all one in a way that almost no other teriyaki we have really is. Like, the sauce is really part of it. It's deep down in the pores of the chicken, right? It's part of the rice. And so I had that, and then I opened up the Teriyaki Madness teriyaki. And it's these, like, too viscous, in my opinion. Right? There is so much viscosity sitting on top of the chicken. Right? It's not in the chicken. It's not marinating the chicken. It's just like the super viscous sauce that is sitting on top of the chicken, in a way.
I mean, this is where we got the viscous sweet nexus, right?
At Teriyaki Madness?
I think so, if we go back.
This was viscous and sweet, I have to say.
That's exactly what I want in my sauce.
It has ratcheted both of those things all the way up.
I would say that, like, if I today were making a choice about, I'm craving teriyaki, I don't really love any of the places right nearby me, where am I going to go? Teriyaki Madness is probably my answer to that question.
You're just wrong on this. I'm sorry. The Yoshino experience is the number one teriyaki experience, possibly, aside from Toshi's. You go in there, you talk to Yoshino, you get this teriyaki that has been poured over, grilled perfectly, right? He pours the sauce on, right? This isn't sauce that comes in a little cup and you dump it yourself.
I mean, Yoshino, sometimes it's not necessarily specifically him who's pouring the sauce, but yes.
Yoshino personally with his hands
pours
the sauce.
That wasn't what happened.
Teriyaki. But also at the same time, the teriyaki is marinated, right? This isn't like a sauce that lives highly viscously on top of your chicken. This is sauce that becomes part of your chicken. This is the essence of Seattle style teriyaki. Predator pass. We don't have a winner.
Well, we're going to have to figure out one of these three. One of the things
There's
I would
no
say
three.
About
There's
this.
Two.
Oh, fine. One of the things I would say about the Capitol Hill locations, amazing efficiency there. Like, they are designed to turn people in and out quickly during your short lunch break. Like, I called Choice Deli today, and it's like 20 minutes is the original estimate for how long it would take.
They're not making teriyaki. They're doing everything.
I called Teriyaki Madness 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. I just didn't even bother calling at Yoshino because of the fact that they're not pre-making it, as you say. They're you know, ladling it out right there, which could be seen as a negative in some ways. But like, I was in and out within like less than a minute and a half, and there was someone else in there in front of me. I mean,
did Yoshino talk to you?
He was in the back.
Okay.
I just talked to the person who was cashiering, who also, like
even
I
better,
said,
even better. Yoshino grilling that chicken to perfection.
So the final choice is going to be Yoshino versus Toshi's?
I mean, I have a choice, and you seem to have a choice.
Well, we can't make Zach the decider go to both of these locations, so he should go to Yoshino.
I mean, I guess it's up to you, but to me, Yoshino is so clearly better than Teriyaki Madness.
Ichiro is the Seattle limits, city limits winner in my heart.
Sure. Yeah, I'll give it to Ichiro. We'll give it to Ichiro for the, I guess, western half of Seattle. If that's how we're breaking up for this teriyaki. To me, Yoshino is it, and it's not even close. Well, it's close. Teriyaki, they're all four of these are good.
You didn't know which was which, so how could it not be close?
Because I was eating both of them, and I was like, wow, I think Yoshino might have lost this. I was like, I think Yoshino kind of went too hard on the glaze this time. But then you told me what it was, and I was like, look at that!
Well, there it is. Our final is set.
You're comfortable with this?
I'll live with it. I'm gonna cast a protest vote. I'm gonna be a faithless elector.
Why do we just freaking every search somebody's mad?
I'm not mad.
Dozone's the winner.
Because if we're being honest, I don't think Ichiro is probably the winner. We'll see. We're going back to Toshi's tomorrow.
Or Teriyaki Madness. Ichiro or Teriyaki Madness? Or is Ichiro to you beats out
Ichiro teriyaki beats out Teriyaki Madness.
Oh, really?
Teriyaki Madness is just more convenient to get to than Ichiro for me. So Teriyaki Madness is the one I would go eat at. But Ichiro is still my favorite.
I thought Ichiro today was quite good, but it's no Yoshino.
Well,
all right,
we will see what
sports.
The decider has to think about
that.
We do have sports to get to. Let's move ahead.
Like, wow, you freaking chatted Zach Whitman, the decider, so fast.
I told him I was going to scoop the pod for him.
All right. Well, again, this Friday at – there you go. That's just for you. 9 o'clock p.m. PDT, the decider, Zach Whitman, will help us crown Seattle's best teriyaki in one quarter. We have the original Seattle's first ever teriyaki. Toshi, the man who invented Seattle-style teriyaki. And in the other corner, we have Yoshino Teriyaki. He might talk to you for longer than you want him to, but his sauce is good. Who will win this battle for Seattle's best teriyaki Friday night, 9 o'clock p.m. with the decider, Zach Whitman?
All right, now it's time for an on-the-fly version of your favorite segment.
Hello.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at ya.
Will, the M's are at it again. Now, it could be a lot of things here. Making a ton of trades under Jerry DePoto. Not making the playoffs. But in this case, what it is winning a lot of games with a terrible run differential. It is the Mariners' signature move. If you look back at like all the times that they've been close to the playoffs in this run, they have never been a good team in any of that. It was maybe 1 or 2 years in there they were a good team. You look at the first half of the 2018 season when they were basically the run differential equivalent of the cartoon where the character runs off of the Roadrunner or whatever, runs off of the cliff. They don't realize they've run off the cliff because they haven't looked down yet. And then eventually they look down and lose like 20 games in a row. That's what the Mariners, they did that in the first month of 2019, and they're doing it again. I have not actually seen what their result was earlier tonight, so it's not quite up to date. But entering tonight's game, they had won 6 consecutive games. They were the opposite of tonight. They lost by 1 run.
Ah!
6 consecutive games. They had won those by a combined 12 runs with 3 one-run wins among those 6. As a result, the Mariners had previously climbed to just 2 games out for second in the AL West behind the Astros and 2 games out of the second wild card behind the Yankees, 2 options for making the playoffs this year that would, some of which would exist in normal years. But their playoff odds, because of their terrible run differential, were still in the single digits. 6.5% per ESPN's projections, 6.6% according to FanGraphs. Very well aligned. The teams that they're chasing, and they've now fallen 2.5 behind Houston and still 2 behind the Yankees who lost tonight. The Yankees have a +3 run differential. The Astros have a +13 run differential. That is 47 runs relative to their opponents better than the Mariners, and somehow that's 2.5 games different. The only team that can make that math work is your Seattle Mariners.
There we go.
Playoff odds down to 4.1% according to ESPN's model after tonight's loss. Let's talk about the Sounders, who had a pair, I would say, of somewhat disappointing outcomes in the past week. On Wednesday, they traveled to Real Salt Lake and led twice in that one, but ended up with a 2-2 draw. They held leads of 1-0 through a Lodero PK in the first half, and then 2-1 through an incredible Yaimer Gomez Andrade header, a rare goal from the run of play from a center back off a cross by Alex Rodon, who was playing right wing back, but surrendered the equalizing goal in the 85th minute in that one to draw 2-2 at Royal Salt Lake. And then a 2-1 loss Sunday at home versus the hated rival Portland Timbers in a derby match. Went down 1-0 to Portland early in that one, clawed back to even at 1-1 on a surprising wonder strike by Kelvin Leerdam as part of their best stretch of football of that match, but then struggled in the second half and allowed the winner to Felipe Mora in the 83rd minute. You watched that match, right?
I did. Just a frustrating match to watch, but honestly, I think in general, Portland maybe seemed like the better team for a lot of it. There were a couple of moments where the Sounders had opportunities, but I'm a little bit afraid this is the MLS's back tournament.
In what sense?
in the sense that Portland dominated it and dominated the Sounders in the match.
I mean, statistically, both of these matches probably should have been draws, I would say.
Well, every soccer match should be a draw statistically.
No, that's not true. It's just that most of the matches the Sounders should win, they lose, and vice versa. So I don't think they were dominated by Portland. I don't want to read too much into that result. The Sounders are definitely still figuring out the back line. They decided to play three center backs at RSL, something I don't recall seeing under Brian Schmetzer. Put Javier Arriaga in there alongside Andrade and Shane O'Neill, who has been filling in throughout this return to play. Arriaga was again the odd man out against Portland, but the second goal in particular went on the center back pairing, who let Mora slip through them trying to play an offside trap that
Leerdam, right?
Yeah, Leerdam played him onside, but it's just too risky, the offside track. I can't go for it.
I hate the offside trap. It's like the fade in football, right? Like, come on. Can we just do away with this? Let's just play some defense.
So the good news is the Sounders are still second in the Western Conference. The bad news now, three teams within a point of them, is the West Race Titans. The Sounders on Thursday will host San Jose in what is currently their last scheduled match that we know of. MLS still has yet to announce schedule plans for phase three of their return to play after this weekend, which the Sounders will have off after that match on Thursday. So still TBD who we're going to be previewing the Sounders against when we get to next week's podcast.
Done seeing the freaking Timbers.
Yeah, it's been a lot of these teams. That is definitely true. San Jose comes in on 9 points and rated in the middle of the pack, but closer to the bottom in the Western Conference. So this is one the Sounders should probably get full points from at home.
Bring on Cincinnati. Let's go.
That's an awful long trip at this point. OL Reign, as we mentioned last week, back in action this weekend, Saturday. They will face the Portland Thorns at 12:30 p.m. on CBS as part of the NWSL Fall Series. So excited to see that kick off. On to the Seattle Storm, who had a 3-0 week in very different fashions in each game. As expected, Sue Bird returned to the lineup last Wednesday in a poor shooting win over the struggling Washington Mystics. Then on Friday in a showdown against the LA Sparks, the Storm's most thrilling game of the season. They trailed the Sparks throughout the first half before the teams traded the lead back and forth all through the second half. Brianna Stewart tied the game with 14 seconds left, only for Raquana Williams to be fouled on a back cut with 0.8 seconds remaining and make both free throws to give the Sparks a two-point lead. The Storm advanced the ball with a timeout, and Sue Bird inbounded the ball to Jewel Lloyd, who caught it in the left corner for an extremely difficult three-pointer, hand in her face, less than a second, knocks it down for the game-winning three. Incredible shot by Jewel Lloyd. And just a big moment. The Storm had a more comfortable time on Sunday against Minnesota, getting the offense going in a 15-point victory as they topped the century mark with 103 points. The Storm's magic number is now one win or one loss by the Sparks to clinch a top two seed and an automatic double bye to the WNBA semifinals. That's really the important thing to be, is in that top two. Las Vegas can still secure the number one seed by winning out, including the season finale between what are currently the WNBA's top two teams, though unclear if that came to pass, how much the Storm would value the number one seed, given that all games in the playoffs are on a neutral court. You do hypothetically get a slightly easier matchup in the semifinals, but I don't know if you'd go all out to try to win that game necessarily.
How many games are left in total?
Three games. On Wednesday, right, They'll host Dallas. Or they'll play against Dallas. That's on CBS Sports at 7 p.m. Friday's game against Phoenix, also on the CBS Sports Network at 7 p.m. And then that finale against Vegas on Sunday at noon on ABC. So wow. Opposite the second half of the Seahawks
Nothing
game.
Nothing else happening on Sunday. Here we go, WNBA.
That's a way that ABC likes to counter-program these football Sundays where there are not NFL games on ABC. By winning out, the Storm could tie the 1998 Houston Comets for the fewest losses in a season with three, albeit in eight fewer games in this shortened season. And they would best the 2010 Storm, who went 28-6, for the best winning percentage in franchise history. They've also got an outside chance at topping the 2000 comment for the best point differential in WNBA history, which is +12.8. They would need to outscore opponents by a combined 61 points in their final three games to get there.
Possible.
Outscoring opponents, yeah, possible but not likely. Outscoring opponents by at least 43 points in their final three games would allow them to join the 98 and 2000 comments. And last year's Washington Mystics is the fourth team in WNBA history to outscore opponents by at least 12 points per game.
I can't believe the comments don't exist anymore.
It is pretty wild.
Like if the Lakers were just like gone.
I mean, it's not quite the same, but you know, if they can move the Sonics. Our UW Athletics front, big news last week from the Pac-12, which announced a testing deal with Quidel Labs, Quidel Corporation, to provide daily rapid results COVID-19 testing for close contact sports. Quidel received emergency use authorization from the FDA for antigen tests rather than the PCR tests that are more commonly used for COVID-19 diagnostic purposes back in May. And they shared their own data in July that the tests are now nearly as sensitive and specific as PCR tests without the long wait for results. These machines are expected to arrive on campuses at the end of September. In announcing this, Pac-12 Commissioner Larry Scott reminded that even with improved testing capacity, the California and Oregon schools still need approval from public health authorities to begin practice, but said he's hopeful that the development will allow football and basketball seasons to begin in the calendar year 2020.
Okay, so what does that mean for football right now?
So another thing he said is that teams would need at least a six-week training camp. So if you look at that from the start of October, that means mid-November is basically the earliest possible starting point for Pac-12 football.
Okay, so the idea is, and how many games are they going to play if you don't play non-conference?
Unclear, but they had previously scheduled, I think, 8 per team? They added a game, so they had 10 per team, I guess.
Interesting. So I mean, you're basically talking about going so potentially some weeks in November, all of December, all of January.
I mean, I don't know if you'd play entirely through winter break. I don't know exactly what they would plan there.
And then is the Big Ten on a similar schedule?
Presumably. I mean, who knows what's happening with the Big Ten exactly.
Or is this just like you have a Pac-12 championship and that's it?
I think it's plausible that you could have the Pac-12 and Big Ten winners play in a Rose Bowl, in air quotes here.
Uh-huh.
And maybe some other schools play. I don't know. I mean, look, we're way into unprecedented territory at this point.
Let's just see what happens. Who cares?
Let's instead look backwards. Let's go back to the year... To the past. The past, Conan? The year 2000. In the year 2000.
We're going to do this every week?
I don't know about every week, but I'm going to do it this way. As we remember the 2000 Huskies season, and we've come to a big one. Week 2, the number 15 Huskies hosted number 4 Miami. It was the first Miami trip ever to UW and the second meeting between the two schools that share the 1991 national championship after the whammy in Miami in 1994 as UW ended Miami's 58-game home winning streak. Surprisingly, College Game Day did not come to – obviously, they did not come to Seattle since they didn't until like 2000 – I don't know, some year, 14?
I was graduated from college.
Oh, it was like way after that. It was the last game. No, it wasn't the last game.
No, they came for an Oregon game before then, which I guess also was the last game. But it was like 2010, I want to say.
It was a long time afterwards, suffice it to say. College Game Day instead went to South Bend for number 23 Notre Dame hosting number 1 Nebraska. And neither of those two teams would end up as high in the polls as either UW or Miami. All right, as we look at the opponent.
This was the year 2000. When Notre Dame and Nebraska still mattered?
Notre Dame sort of still does. Miami was coming off a 9-4 season capped by a win over Georgia Tech in the Gator Bowl. Now, that may not sound that impressive, but 3 of their 4 losses came to teams ranked in the top 3 at the time.
Wow.
At number 1, Florida State. At number 2, Virginia Tech. And then number 3, Penn State. They also inexplicably lost at East Carolina. They then beat McNeese State 61-14 in their season opener, moving up a spot in the polls. Starting quarterback Ken Dorsey had started three games as a true freshman in place of injured starter Kenny Kelly in 1999 and was taking over the job full-time after Kelly decided to focus on playing minor league baseball. This was the first road start, notably, for Ken Dorsey. The running back rotation for Miami, James Jackson, who washed out fairly quickly in the NFL. He was a third-round pick. Quinton Portis and Najee Davenport, a group, the latter two, to which they would add Frank Gore and Willis McGahee the next year. Their wide receivers were highlighted by Santana Moss and Reggie Wayne. Huh? They also had a freshman named Andre Johnson and a tight end named Jeremy Shockey. The only big name on the offensive line was Bryant McKinney at that point. Their defense wasn't maybe quite as talented as future years, but all they did was start six first-round picks. Ed Reed, Philip Buchanan, Willip Joseph, Damian Lewis, Mike Rumpf, and Dan Morgan. The next year's Miami team has to go down as the most talented college football team of all time, I think.
Of all time?
I think so.
I mean, this
just was... Just in terms of, like, NFL talent?
No, when you look at that Miami team, it's pretty ridiculous. There may be some others that are competitive, but... This was the outline of that Miami team the next season that would have put it all together. This was the beginning of all that. Like,
oh, it was definitely the beginning of all that.
The talent was there. And I mean, obviously we saw what they did to the Huskies the following year. But like, there was so much talent on this team that I think at the very least for us in our lifetimes, like, we look back on this, and when the Huskies were getting destroyed by Miami the following year, it was like, okay.
It was an honor just to be on the field.
It really was. That's how much talent was on that team and how exciting they were. And to have them even coming to Seattle in this season was so thrilling because you could see that it was starting to come. Miami still meant something, too. You know, we weren't as far removed as we are now from the early 90s Miami teams.
I mean, they meant something in part because of what they were doing at that point. But yes.
They definitely did. But, like, this was Miami, right? Like, Miami mattered then. And it's been... Honestly, it's been more than a decade since they've really mattered in the same way. You mentioned Notre Dame and Nebraska. Similar program. Like, these are all 90s programs, early 2000s programs.
You know, people used to say that about UW.
UW, too? I mean, UW has obviously had a resurgence, but, like, this was one of, if not maybe the most important college football team in the country at the time.
So the Huskies, against maybe the most important college football team in the country at that time, dominated the first half, taking a 21-3 lead. Then after Miami's first touchdown in the third quarter, true freshman Rich Alexis in his second game went 50 yards for the touchdown. This is like the play I remember the most.
Oh, the play I remember. This is not the play I remember the most.
All right, we'll get to that, I'm sure.
Yes.
After two more Canes touchdowns, the Huskies marched for a score on a Pat Conniff one-yard run to take a 34-22 lead. Miami closed to 34-29 inside the last 3 minutes, but could not recover an onside kick and did not get the ball back until 20 seconds remained on the clock as the Huskies got the crucial non-conference victory. Marcus Tuiasosopo went 18 of 31 for 223 yards and ran for 45 yards in this one, although he also had several turnovers in the second half. The Huskies held James Jackson to 11 carries for 34 yards in this one and really did an impressive number on Ken Dorsey, who has completed 15 of 34 passes, a seemingly unthinkable total these days, for 215 yards. Besides that Alexis touchdown, the other highlight that I'm sure you're referring to was Anthony Vontour, cornerback, sacking Dorsey on a corner blitz and causing a fumble that set up a touchdown to give the Huskies the 21-3 lead.
Yep.
Santana Moss fumbling when he got destroyed in a punt return?
Maybe it was the punt return. I thought it was reception, but the punt return.
No, it was a punt return.
The punt return that Santana Moss had, which Santana Moss was, I think he might have been related to Randy Moss. Is that right?
I don't think so.
He was a huge name at the time, about to be a first-round NFL draft pick. Santana Moss was this big name.
They're not related.
And then gets crushed on this return. Back in the early 2000s where we would get excited about that. And it was right at the beginning of the game, if I want to say correctly. And
Tyler Cranbrook. It was not right at the beginning of the game.
That was, to me, what set the tone of that game.
Like the physicality of it?
And just like, oh, like I remember going into it being like, oh, Huskies can't win this game, right? And then it was like, oh, crap. Like they are on the same field. They're playing the same sport as Miami is here. They're not overmatched as we feel.
We want to get Washington back to the glory days, Huskies linebacker Jafar Williams said. Today proves to us that we're on our way back.
Man, well, one team was on their way back to the glory days. After that, the Huskies were this season.
No, they were.
They were.
Yeah, 100% that season.
But what is really impressive is where Miami went after this.
They won their next 34 games.
34 games!
34 games! Miami won out, including a 27-24 home win over number one Florida State and a 41-21 home win over Virginia Tech. Controversially left out of the BCS championship game. Much more on that as we go through the Huskies 2000 season. And then beat number seven Florida 37-20 in the Sugar Bowl to finish number two in the polls. Their next loss would not come until the BCS championship game against Ohio State after the 2002 season.
And that was was the Willis McGahee injury game.
Wow. Yeah. That's still one of those games. Like, I remember the Sonics game I was at.
I was going to say, I was home alone. I remember being home alone watching that. You weren't there.
You skipped the Sonics game to watch the national championship.
I don't know why I wasn't at the Sonics game.
It probably was a pretty forgettable Sonics game, if we go back into the archives.
I definitely didn't forget it. I definitely didn't skip it to watch the 2002 BCS championship game. There had to be some reason that I didn't go. But, I mean, this was, you look at, the Huskies are the thorn in Miami's side.
Really are.
It's pretty wild. So they played three times ever, is that right?
Yeah,
they played
so.
Three times ever. One was the whammy in Miami. The other was beating them for the last time before they win 34 in a row. I mean, honestly, the Huskies held them out of the BCS championship. This would have been a perfect season without this loss.
Correct. The Sonics lost to the Denver Nuggets 94-82 on January 3rd, 2003. Some stats
Sean
in this
Leonard
game.
Had a nice game.
He actually did not play in this one. Let's see here. The leading scorer with Gary Payton had 25 points and 14 assists for the Sonics. Desmond Mason had 21 in that one, but the bench totaled just 7 points. Vlade Radmanovic, 1 of 9 from
Vlade.
The field in the loss. So he
and
was
and then
struggling.
The third time that these two teams play each other, they beat the Huskies 1,000,000 points to zero.
It only felt that bad. It was, again, 61-7 was the final.
Wow.
Or 65-7, I should say. And the Huskies were ranked number 12 in the country going to that game. Here's some games they played. The week before, they had played number 14 Syracuse. They beat them 59-9.
Donovan McNabb Syracuse?
No, that would have been post-Donovan McNabb. Yeah, or Jay Anderson was starting at quarterback. But they played two teams ranked in the top 15 in consecutive weekends, and they beat them by a combined 124-7. But at least we weren't shut out.
I mean, that really shows just how impressive this win is, though. Like, this victory against Miami is up there with the greatest wins in Husky history.
Absolutely. I was going to say, I think this is the best team the Huskies ever beat.
Wow. I mean, they won 34 in a row after that. Like, they haven't played that many teams this good.
Exactly. Yeah, I stand by it.
It was maybe some Pete Carroll USC teams.
They beat Colorado. Did they beat Colorado in 1990, which was the year that Colorado won the national championship?
But were they this good, though? You could win the can win the national championship and not be the team that won 34 games in a row after. New Heisey.
No, they lost to Colorado in 1990. That was the one loss, one of the losses for the Huskies. Okay. I'm misremembering that.
Wow. What a freaking game. Week 2!
Yeah.
Ooh.
All right, let's wrap up with the Seahawks. We got a lot to get to here because the season is starting, ready or not. Let's start with the news. Jadeveon Clowney signs a one-year deal with the Tennessee Titans worth up to $15 million. He's finally not coming back.
John Schneider's monitoring the situation.
I mean, on the one hand, I sort of get that the Seahawks were like, we couldn't be in a situation where we went through all of training camp not knowing whether we were going to have a pass rush. But on the other hand, like, if you would have known at the beginning of the offseason that you could have signed Jadeveon Clowney for $15 million, like, up to $15 million, I think it's 13.5 base, like, you do that deal 100 times out of 100.
It seems like the Seahawks did offer that, though.
Well, yeah, they did offer that, but they weren't willing to keep that on the table.
It's tough to keep that on the table without making other plans.
But if the other plans are Benson Mayo, is it really that good of a plan?
I mean, I'm not saying that this was a good decision by the Seahawks, but like, I can understand why they did it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. It's still a bad outcome for the Seahawks.
Not getting Jadeveon Clowney was a bad outcome for the Seahawks, no shit. But like,
there's situations where it would have been like he signed some contract, is like, well, okay, I wouldn't have paid him that anyway.
And they are obviously just not consistently one of these. Well, I don't want to say consistently. It seems like players that you would have thought they would have wanted back, sometimes they don't re-sign for the right numbers. And those players go for less than you would think. You know, when Sheldon Richardson signed with the Vikings, it was just like, wait, he signed for what? Like, wait, why didn't we do that? You know? Right. And I think that's obviously the same perspective that you'd have about Clowney. I think there is part of it that seems like Clowney just wanted to play with the Titans. He wanted to get back to Vrabel and play together with him.
I don't know if he would have felt the same way if he had had a stronger offer on the table from the Seahawks. Because clearly their offer was not this high at this point.
I don't know. They fucked it up.
Eventually, Jadeveon Clowney will come back because all players come back to the Seahawks, including Josh Gordon, who officially re-signed last week a one-year deal at the minimum. He's still on the suspended list as he and the Seahawks await word from the NFL about his status.
Are we expecting him to be suspended for a certain amount of games once he is reinstated?
So I think probably so, to the extent that there was a PED as part of this suspension on top of the weed aspect, which probably will get, if not reduced, if not waived entirely, at least reduced. But I don't know. It's the NFL. Who knows? They make it up as they go.
Just like us with teriyaki.
Yes. The Seahawks' final 53-man roster. Or is it 53? I guess. Is it still 53? They've just increased the practice squad. All right. The final roster is set, at the very least. No huge surprises from cutdown day in a year without the preseason. Paul Richardson did not make the team after limited practice opportunities, signing late. The Seahawks, after the roster was first cut down, added defensive end / outside linebacker DeAndre Walker to the roster off waivers. The 2019 fifth-round pick by Tennessee missed his rookie season due to injuries, but the Seahawks liked him before the draft and will give him a look. And then they waived John Ursua on Tuesday, disappointing to the Ursua Hive, and promoted wide receiver Penny Hart, which is not the name of a Beatles song, but is the name of a football player, from the practice squad to the 53-man roster.
What about a host of, like, Inside Edition?
Could also be that.
Right.
It's actually the wife of former presidential candidate Gary Hart, I'm pretty sure.
Sad to lose John Ursua, who, you know, possibly could come back. It's definitely one of those things where...
Wouldn't be surprising if you wave him at this point that you can sneak him through to the practice squad.
Yeah, it's one of those things where this is a situation, look, I don't implicitly trust Pete and John with personnel decisions, see Clowney, Jadeveon, but this is one of those things where it's just like, they know better than we do. Like, the reality is they have seen Penny Hart play, and they have seen John Ursua play. So I think this is one that's just like, we can hem and haw about it. They probably understand who's better between these two players, or at least more useful to them in the scheme and what's happening right now for the team.
I suppose so.
Right? This is not Carol an said, allocation of resources issue. This is a they chose one player versus another player issue.
Yes. But one player did have a huge catch against San Francisco in Week 17.
Nobody factors that in. Wait. Everybody factors that in.
Oh, they factor that in too much, as it turns out. Pete Carroll said, no decision yet on a starter at right cornerback. Quentin Dunbar still going through COVID-19 protocol after leaving the team to attend a funeral last week. The New York Daily News reported Tuesday that police obtained text messages from a friend that again linked Dunbar to active participation in the armed robbery in which no charges were filed against him. So we'll see what, if anything, comes of that. But, just monitoring the situation, I suppose.
That's what the Seahawks do best.
The Seahawks announced last week that they'll wear helmet decals supporting social justice initiatives and honoring victims of racism and police brutality. This is something that, like, I think we've become somewhat skeptical of the idea of, like, oh, we're promoting awareness. But I do think, especially in the case of local victims, that it is important for the Seahawks to be doing this. I mean, I know in particular it's been striking how much Manuel Ellis's case has disappeared from the local media as the investigation that's going on of, you know, the role that the officers arresting him played in his death has, you know, just continued to drag out for months and months now.
I mean, there's that. There's so many more cases that are not as prominent, but I mean, I look at the killing of Andres Guardado. This is not local, but in Gardena, California, who's somebody there was a whistleblower report that the person who ended up shooting him was part of a gang as part of the police department. Like, there is more attention that needs to be paid to these victims more than just Jacob Blake or George Floyd. Like, there are so many more victims that have not gotten the attention because there isn't a tape, right? And if...
Or just because there's a limited attention span.
If there's any additional attention that the Seahawks or the NFL or whomever can shine on these cases, I'm all for it. The one that felt like, you know, Drew Brees with the just Jacob Blake decal on his helmet was just like, okay.
You know, I think we can...
It's better than him not, I suppose.
Exactly. That's the way to put it. Let's talk about this Atlanta game, the season opener for the Seahawks.
A football game? A real live football game?
In this economy. When we last saw the Falcons, they were dropping to 1-7 with their 27-20 loss to the Seahawks the week before their bye, with Matt Schaub tearing up the Seahawks defense in semi-garbage time. Over the break, then Dan Quinn gave up play-calling duties on defense, and Atlanta went 6-2 after the bye. The defense improved from 30th in DVOA through the first 8 games of the season to finally ranking 17th, so clearly dramatic improvement. That run allowed Quinn to keep his job, but he promoted Raheem Morris to defensive coordinator, a role he technically filled last season after fellow former Seahawks assistant Marquand Manuel was fired as defensive coordinator after the 2018 season. A somewhat busy offseason for Atlanta. The Falcons waived both Husky legend Desmond Trufant and Devontae
Freeman.
What team
is Trufant?
That is a great question that I do not know.
I'm just learning that he was waived right now, so.
I had completely forgotten him, if I was being honest. He is playing for the Detroit Lions. There we go. They added edge rusher Dante Fowler from the Rams on a 3-year, $45 million contract to replace Vic Beasley, who signed with the Titans. They lost
really?
Tight end Austin Hooper.
You knew about that Vic Beasley signing, too?
No. I mean, don't remember any of this. This happened during the height of the pandemic.
Wait, I just like all of these things that were happening, I was just like, there's no fucking way there's going to be football. The whole time is like, Tom Brady will never play a snap with the Buccaneers. Come on.
Apparently he's been on the non-football injury list for the Titans, has now been activated, and is being listed behind Jadeveon Clowney on the Titans depth chart. They lost tight end Austin Hooper to the Browns in free agency and traded for Hayden Hurst from the Ravens to replace him. They replaced Freeman at running back with our old friend Todd Gurley on a one-year $5.5 million deal, and then drafted Clemson cornerback A.J. Terrell with the number 16 overall pick to fill that spot, that void left by Trufant's release. Matt Ryan, still very good despite the team's struggles. A solid year last year, number 9 in completion percentage over expected based on the passes he was throwing, and number 11 in the CPOA and expected points added EPA composite last season, put together by our friend Ben Baldwin on his site, rbsdm.com, which is actually not an NC-17 site, but is football stats. Somewhat surprisingly, only 13th in past EVOA
what
last season.
What does rbsdm.com stand for?
Running backs don't matter. Come on, of course. Kelvin Ridley was number 2 in DVOA among receivers last year. Julio Jones was just number 21, but they finished 5th and 7th respectively in DR, Football Outsiders value metric. No other Atlanta receiver had double-digit DR, so it was really just the two of those guys who were
threats. They traded Sanu midway through the year.
Correct. Yeah, that's not counting him, yes. And Russell Gage stepped into that third receiver role. And then also they had Austin Hooper providing a lot of value. But intriguingly, Hurst last season in Baltimore actually had a better DVOA. He ranked 4th than Hooper, who ranks 6th. He was just kind of the odd man out with Mark Andrews there. Baltimore tight ends did seem to benefit a lot from Lamar Jackson, yes, and the run threat there, so we'll see if he can be similarly effective with Matt Ryan, who does not present the same threat with his legs.
All right, well, the Atlanta Falcons.
There you go.
It really, you know, here we are kicking off 2020 talking at the Atlanta Falcons, a team that has been one of the most difficult teams to understand over the last 3 to 4 seasons, right? And you go into this game really having almost no ability to predict what it's going to look like, and especially what this Falcons team could be.
No ability?
I could see the Falcons being, they have the potential to be the number 1 seed in the NFC, and they have the potential to be 1-15. Like, the range of possibilities for the season for the Atlanta Falcons is wider than almost any team in the NFC. There's clearly a lot of talent on this team, and for whatever reason, it has not turned into wins, especially early in the year for these Falcons. They seem to have picked it up a little bit more later in these last couple of seasons, but you just go into it and you're like, they clearly can score. It seems like the defense is better. I don't know what the flaw is in this Falcons team.
A question, by the way. Are the Falcons the new Panthers in terms of the Seahawks always playing them? This is the 5th meeting between these two teams in the last 5 seasons, including the 2016 playoff matchup.
Sure. I'll go for that. And also, not being able to understand them. In the same way that those Panthers games where it felt like for like 5-6 years we were just like, what happened to this game? Like,
I mean, my takeaway from the Panthers games is always like, Cam Newton is so terrifying. It seems impossible to ever stop them from getting a first down. How did they not go 16-0 all the time? Which they kind of did the one season.
1 year. But I mean, the Falcons are the same way sometimes too. It's been a while, and obviously they've gotten worse. But like, I think at least me, and I assume you also, will always be a Matt Ryan apologist.
Hall of Fame.
Hall of Famer Matt Ryan apologist. Like,
we are both, we think that he should be in the Hall of Fame, but we also are in the Hall of Fame of Matt, yes, Ryan apologists.
Mm-hmm. I just look at this team and it feels like, could they have put it all together? Could this be?
It's like the poor man's version of the Peyton Manning Colts.
No.
Where Like, the, you know, the offense is always going to be at a certain level.
This is they're waiting to have. The Peyton Manning Colts isn't. Matt Ryan is not Peyton Manning on the Colts.
That's why I said it's the poor man's version.
This is the waiting to have their renaissance version of the New Orleans Saints, of their bitter rivals. This was, the Saints were great, and then they were down for a few years, and then it all came back together. That is going to happen with these Falcons. Is it going to be this year? Is it going to be next year? Who knows?
But the Falcons had 1 year where they were good at defense, and or I guess 2 years where they went to the.
I mean, they were an excellent team for quite a few years, and one year they won the Super Bowl.
No, they weren't actually any good at defense the year they went to the Super Bowl. They were just that good at offense.
This is a very good team on paper. Find me the flaw, and for some reason there's still a flaw.
The flaw is defense. That's a big. It's like half the game. And what it isn't is consistent from year to year is offenses. So that's why if you're going to have a flaw, you want it to be defense. But it's still a flaw, and it still might lead you to missing the playoffs 2 years in a row.
It's only been 2 years since they missed – and they snuck in the previous year and lost
2017 was the year where they beat out the Seahawks for the final spot in the playoffs on the last day of the regular season. Yes. They were not actually that good of a team that year, but then neither were the Seahawks.
But they lost to the Rams in the playoffs? Or is that the next year?
That sounds right. That's a lot more specifics about the 2017 Atlanta Falcons.
So they ranked 17th in defense last year, which I don't want to say is terrible, right?
They beat the Rams. They lost to the Eagles.
Oh, yeah.
A pretty close game. That was the one where they had that was like the whole Sark year where it was like their struggles in the red zone, right? And then Sark got scapegoated for it.
And they were number 15 on offense last year. Like this team is better than that. I refuse to accept that they are a 15th best offense and a 17th best defense. Like if their defense is 17th best, this will be a good Falcons team.
It should be really good.
There is never a situation that I go into a game against the Falcons. Look, we've been burned too many times by them in the playoffs twice.
I mean, we felt pretty confident. We felt pretty confident going into that game against Matt Schaub before he threw for 400 plus yards.
Okay, how about this? If Matt Schaub starts on Sunday, then I feel confident. Okay. If there's another Matty Ice starting on Sunday, then I feel confident. But like, otherwise. It's a very talented Falcons team who's picked up Hayden Hurst. It's just such a difficult game to predict what is going to happen going into it.
I don't think it's as first off, every game is unpredictable. Things just random. Any given Sunday, teams can win. I think you're overestimating the randomness here.
Tell me otherwise.
I mean, the Seahawks should be favored in this game.
Should they?
Yeah. They're the better of these two teams. I mean, like, you look at ESPN's preseason football power index, the Seahawks are 7th, Atlanta is 18th. They're 1.5-point favorites in Vegas.
1.5-point
I mean, I don't think they're dramatic favorites.
Are we still given 3 points for favorites for home field, even if there are no fans?
I believe what I've seen is that it's 2.5 points.
I mean,
I think Ben B tweeted about
that. And so when are they traveling? Are they traveling on Saturday?
Correct. 4:10 a.m. start on Sunday morning.
It doesn't feel good to me. It's really tough. Again, we have no feel for either of these teams. It's week one. Week one is always.
I mean, would we have more feel for these teams if we had seen like all their reserves play in the preseason?
No, we don't have a feel for them no matter what. That's the thing. We don't have a feel for them because it's week one.
Far.
And also, this is because the Atlanta Falcons are always going to be scary.
Sure. What are the chances of victory?
I'm looking forward to when we have a little bit more information to go off of here. Again, I look at last year's team and I don't say to myself that this is the 15th best offense in the NFL. This is a top 10.
I agree with that. I mean, the FPI does not predict them as the 15th best offense. It predicts them as 12th.
I think they are a top 10 offense, the Atlanta Falcons. And if they have an average defense this year, they're going to be a playoff caliber team. I think people,
but they might also not have an average
people
defense.
People are underrating the Falcons just a little bit going into this year. It's not a soft landing for the Seahawks. I think there is a 43% chance of victory for the Seahawks.
I think there's a 55% chance of victory. And this is a very unusual way for us to start our first odds of percentage chances of winning of 2020 with me being much more optimistic than you are.
I'm not going to a Falcons game confident. That's it.
I'm not going into the live show confident. That's it.
Like, neither of us is going to the live show confident.
Reminder.
Is there anything? We have to also mention Shaquem Griffin, though. As far as roster changes, you know, maybe it's not a huge deal on the field, but we still love Shaquem Griffin.
Sure. I mean, I don't think it's a big change for him to be on the practice squad.
No, there was a risk, though. And it does seem to show that, I mean, this is somebody who was making an impact in the playoffs last year, right? Like, making one of the key plays in the playoffs. And then to be
I think it turns out that may have said more about the Seahawks pass rush than it did about Shaquem Griffin.
I also do, when we talk about Jadeveon Clowney, you know, I think there's a conversation to be had of, are the Seahawks, I don't want to give analytics any credit here because I don't think this is the way that they're approaching it, but there does seem to be some growing and building evidence that pass rush is significantly less important for a good defense than pass defense. And are you skeptical about that?
I mean, the problem with this argument, I'm not skeptical of that point of evidence. I'm skeptical of the argument that the Seahawks are actually employing it, because the problem is they still paid a decent amount of money for pass rushers. They just paid for guys without the track record as players of Jadeveon Clowney.
Oh, no. Look, but who I'm maybe a
better
Seahawks
measurable statistic.
No credit here whatsoever. But
okay.
No, I mean, they obviously paid massive amounts for Jamal Adams. Like, if you want to talk about paying things, like, they paid the most for Jamal Adams.
That's not what I'm saying, though. I'm saying that they're paying, you know, Bruce Irvin's counting $6 million against the cap. Benson Mayoa is counting, I guess it's only $3 million. Like,
you've
together they're counting 60% of Jadeveon
Clowney. Pete Carroll's loved a player that he used to coach.
Well, he used to coach Jadeveon Clowney.
No. They need to leave and come back for Pete Carroll to love them.
The $7 million for Greg Olsen is a lot.
Oh, how dare you?
I like Greg Olsen, but that's just a lot, especially
so
with this
many
helping.
Tight ends on this team. Look at the roster; it's like, wow. It just keeps going. They've got four Greg Olsons on the roster.
Only one of them is a damn superhero, and only one of them is capable of doing color analysis
and
like of games he's currently playing on.
The thrill is back, though.
The thrill is back.
That's all that matters. Look. I say this just going into a situation where I'm going to assume that being a road game versus a home game matters. I think the travel matters. I think there are a lot of unknowns in the situation. I think the Seahawks in the end will probably end up as a better team than the Falcons, but I don't feel confident about this particular game.
Okay.
Most importantly, though, we're going to be watching NFL football on Sunday.
It's going to be really weird.
Wild is that? Like, it's coming. We are finally here. We've been through a lot, but the idea that we are going to wake up on Sunday morning, 5 days from today, two days
from today as we record this, there's going to be an NFL football game. It will involve the Seahawks.
2 days after, we've been at PeltonCast live from home and watching the Seahawks play a real game that counts. I just really I can't even process the feelings.
Are we doing recap pods in every game this year?
I got nothing else to do.
I mean, I do actually have a lot to do. The NBA playoffs will be going on.
It's
going
to be
well, we may have to find
strange.
A way. The NBA playoffs are going on during a Seahawks game 2020.
Oh my God, there's so much happening. I mean, I think about that with the Pac-12, they start in November. It's like they're going to be it'll be like a Husky game and then the Super Bowl the next day.
It'll be like a Husky football game, Husky basketball.
It's going to be, the whole thing is very strange in a way that is very strange how we've come to football happening, but just excited to start watching it, you know, to have Scott Hansen back in our life. 10 a.m. on Sunday. It's going to be beautiful in the city of Seattle, and we're going to be watching the Seahawks play a game in a dome on the opposite end of the country.
But again, before that, mark your calendars. Friday night, 9 p.m. We'll preview the Seahawks season. We're obviously going to talk a lot about Seahawks with Mina Kimes, not just all Rams. And then specifically a Seahawks season preview with Natalie Weiner and Mike Sean Dugar of The Athletic Seattle. So can't wait, and hope to see everyone there.
Insider Zach Whitman, and we will not allow him to talk about football.
Absolutely not. Actually, I've got a plan for him to talk a little bit about football, but we'll see. I haven't told you that plan yet.
Also, keep an eye out for our annual Over Unders podcast plus fantasy football review.
Yeah, we'll see if we have time for that.
We're about to record it right now, so you better have time for it.
We haven't completed our drafts yet.
Oh, I thought we were doing it right now. Oh, we're doing it post Champions League. Come on.
No, we gotta wait until draft against each other in the other league. First off, it's 11:30 p.m. We're not doing it right now.
I was ready. I was freaking into it.
No. On that note,
thanks for listening.
Thanks.